It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. It is February 8th, 2012, and as you know, on this show, we talk about things related to health, environment, and animals. I always try and mix it up a little bit, and today we're going to focus on the first part of the show with animals. We're all animals, people, and all the other species on this planet that we share everything with, the air, the water, the soil. And I'm going to bring on Priscilla Farrell, who is the president of Friends of Animals. Friends of Animals is a nonprofit international animal advocacy organization, which was incorporated in the state of New York in 1957. Friends of Animals works to cultivate a respectful view of non-human animals, free living and domestic. The goal? To free animals from cruelty and institutionalize exploitation around the world. Welcome, Priscilla, to It's All About Food.
Hey there. How are you? Thank you.
Good. I just want to know everything that we possibly can talk about Friends of Animals. You're doing so many amazing things, and I didn't even know that you've been around for so long, since 1957.
Absolutely, and I feel like I started there when I was in grammar school. but seriously, I lived in Connecticut. The office for the corporation was in New York City. And I was going through some early kind of career counseling on what in the hell do I do with my life as a career. I want to do something beyond taking stenography and typing. And I was a member of Friends of Animals, having had my cats stayed there. So I took a train to New York and interviewed with the president, and she had, you know, her assistant was leaving, and after a very short interview, she just said, "You're hired, and, you know, make sure you show up on time." And I said, "Well, what's the job?" And she said, "Stir up a hornet's nest." And that was that was November 1974.
Wow.
So I've worked there 38 years and have been president 25 years.
Wow.
And what I think I'm probably most proud of is trying to maintain the kind of rigorous style that I was attracted to, that she showed all of us, and that was independent thinking. To be a smaller, you know, medium to smaller sized group that worked hard and wasn't anxious to be part of somebody's flock. And I think that serves as well through the years.
Oh, absolutely. Now, did it start out as an organization to spay and neuter?
It did, but that was kind of a secondary effect, because what Alice Harrington, the president, did was she said, you know, she always loved cats, and she tried to start as kind of an adoption group of sorts. And she told me, she said, for every cat I adopted out in New York City, another one came back.
Mm.
And she realized that the burden of trying to have an impact on the homeless crisis was going to require affordable spay-neuter surgery. So what she started out then, and a program we maintain today, is a nationwide program that attracts people to a network of vets that we have, and we've produced, I guess, 2.6 million surgeries at this point.
Wow.
Which has spared a lot of cats and dogs in existence where they end up in a miserable situation.
Now, did Friends of Animals always have a vegan focus as well?
No, but the first focus on animals is food, and certainly the first factory farming expose really was ours, and it was crafted by both Peter Singer and Jim Mason back in 1974, and they did that work and that investigation and produced those books, you know, in our library and there on the spot. So I became educated about animal farming through Friends of Animals, and the vegetarian advocacy really followed. I mean, all of us in the office, it was kind of a program where the more we were aware of, and we really weren't aware of a vegetarian movement,
yeah,
per se, but we were aware of conscious lives and had stopped eating animals. And it was just kind of a visceral reaction to the information that was gathered for campaigns.
The movement that you talk about, it's certainly a movement today, and there's lots of, certainly the internet, social networking has enabled us to get that message out far more effectively than ever before. But you've been doing this a really long time. So two questions. What do you see as the things that you're happiest with, you're proudest with about the vegan movement, and where are the frustrations still today?
What I'm happiest with, I think the vegan cooking shows now being designed for television. Vegan Mashup is one that we're going to sponsor. I'm just wild about a cookbook author and a member of Friends of Animals, Miyoko Shinner. And, you know,
we talked to them a few weeks ago
vegetarian.
We talked to them a few weeks ago on this show. Yeah, great stuff.
She is really brilliant. You know, she's brilliant in person. What she produces is brilliant. Her new book is going to be perfect. I mean, I see her as a breakthrough cook and artist.
Mm.
And I think she's going to inspire a lot of people to move away from cheese and dairy. And she's just lovely on top of it all. But I'm a cookbook junkie and a food channel junkie. So I love to watch people doing demonstrations of food, prepping food, plating food. You know, I've got two vegan cookbooks that I authored, and I like cooking. So to me, this inspires people. And if you're in a leadership role in anything, it's not about motivating people that produces change. It really is inspiration. And I think showing people how to do it in such an attractive way by people who are savvy and bright and have good social skills, this is the way to really get great ideas to evolve. So I'm thrilled about it. I'm happiest about that. I'm the most disappointed, perhaps, with a trend among some large groups to try to obtain concessions from animal exploitation industries.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that perhaps as, I mean, I understand that it's more lucrative to try to work that way because people are more agreeable and they're inconvenienced less, but I think it's the wrong way to build veganism as a social movement. And if we're going to have it thrive as a social movement, meaning it's working around the globe, you know, not just here, you really have to renounce domination and systematic killing. And that isn't cracking a deal with industry.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, but this concept of animal rights versus animal welfare and the organizations that are trying to get whatever they can, rather than focusing
right
on the real point. Is
right
torture okay if it's a little less torture than more torture?
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, I just got back from West Africa because we have a reintroduction project in Senegal. And I could tell you how demoralizing it was, and really shocking for me to travel 3,000 miles within 3 days by land. So I saw a lot of landscape in northern Senegal, and the landscape was really saturated with livestock, with goats, sheep, and cows. And this is an arid area of Senegal, so it, you know, it's not tropical, it's not rainforest, it's not some of the jungle habitat that they really do have elsewhere, but it's where farming is animal farming. And if you look at that and all the trees cut down, you know, for firewood, and the lack of electricity and the poverty, all these people really think about is eating meat as some form of status. And, of course, we set that example here in the United States, what we think status is about, right, a steak or some such thing. And the crime in that so much was not only are indigenous animals replaced with this livestock grazing and how miserable it is for animals, there's no factory farming involved. It's not that animals are confined in close quarters. It's that they're betrayed. And they're betrayed right in front of your face. And they also head to the same slaughter area that any animal heads to if it's considered food. So whether the animal can be, you know, out in an open space, or whether it's confined and has so many days of living and then its head is cut off, it's really the same at the end. And yet, as a animal rights movement, so many of us are left to try to mitigate, you know, these miseries along the way. And I think it's a giant mistake. I think what I saw in Senegal was deeply depressing on several levels. But to come back here and to have this chatter about, oh, it's factory farming, as though all you have to do is kind of put a different, you know, fix on that and it will all be okay. Look, Peter Singer and Jim Mason started doing that in 1974. In the year 2012, we're at the same place.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yep. Good Lord. well, you're doing great things. And what are you doing in West Africa? You have a project there.
You know, about a week ago, I was on 60 Minutes for a segment on this project, actually. The upshot is we're keeping three species that were prized at Texas hunting ranches and that brought the industry there about $1 billion a year out of these hunting ranches. And the way we got there was to not only start a reintroduction project in Senegal, that's what we did in 1999, and that gave us the standing to make the Fish and Wildlife Service list these three antelope species as endangered because they were rendered extinct in their African homelands, but to stop the Fish and Wildlife Service from giving a blanket exemption to the hunting ranches in Texas, meaning they could breed them, trade them, sell them, shoot them, and call it an act of conservation, if you can believe that. And these oryx antelopes or drama gazelles or attic antelopes lived a year, maybe 2 years max, before they became a trophy for somebody's wall. And these are wealthy tourists who ride on the same plane to Texas I ride on every month, you know, going there to shoot at these hunting ranches, and they pay maybe $5,000 to $10,000 to shoot one of these animals that is half tame. They're not particularly afraid of people, and they're trained to go to a certain area for water and trained to come to a bell when there's corn to feed them, what have you. And they call that, you know, a safari club adventure. And depending on the quality of the poor animal's head, they get points from Safari Club International in their, you know, trophy book. And these are demented things that people called hunters do in the United States. In Africa, where I went, they're trying to reintroduce some of those animals that were wiped out by French trophy hunters many decades ago. And right now, the animals we've brought there and we've established in protected reserves number about 175 individuals from one and a few dozen of the other, and they're protected. So that to me, you know, if you're trying to observe the rights and interests of an animal within an ecosystem and you're protecting that habitat, that approach is conservation, not that hunting scheme in Texas.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I've heard about this kind of, quote, hunting, and there's so many crazy things going on in the world. You can't really rank them, but this one is, it's so shameful.
Yeah.
These people have no idea of what they're doing, and they're just bored or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Also, within, you know, the contingent of people that call themselves, you know, males, there's a pride involved here that, you know, involving some kind of sense of power of stealing a life of another, you know, and that, I mean, when someone shoots a deer in some areas of the country, that body is put on top of the car, I think, is a way to exhibit some kind of applause or, gee, that looks like that was quite a feat, you know, what you did, you with a gun and the animal with nothing, you know. But really, what's obscene, even though there are just 12 million of these people in the United States left, is that they have a stranglehold on so much of the government policy. And it includes the Obama administration and a few administrations before that, until you get back to Bill Clinton. And then we really did see some positive changes there. So there's so much to do. And there are pundits among, you know, the animal rights community who think that all we have to do is talk about what we consider food, and that cures every other ill. I think that's selling a lot of animals short. You know, they're indigenous wild animals that also are afforded rights, or they ought to be, right? And that means you have to care about the space you're living in and sharing. And if you continue to consume animals, you know, from big flocks and farms, that's land that's off limits to wild horses and wolves and coyotes and lots of other animals that deserve a place on this earth too. So I think a lot of this relates, and I'm thrilled to talk about food and to try to encourage the right trends, but I think there's a broader perspective that perhaps like-minded groups, I would hope, would begin to embrace and use as educational points for their members.
Yeah, I agree with you. But the thing about food is that it's a way to crack open the door and make people pay attention. And I find that a lot of people who realize they don't need meat to survive, all of a sudden, or at some point during their journey, have this epiphany, and they realize what's going on around them, and they realize that all of these other animals that they're not eating and those that are out are individuals and deserve a life. And because food is so close to us and we use it almost every day, that I think it's the easiest way to get people to realize what's going on all around them. But there are so many issues. And, you know, people, I'm sure you've heard this, where people will say, you know, why do you care so much about animals? You don't care about people. And we treat people just as horribly as we do animals.
Well, yeah, and you create the body that you're living with by the way you care for it and how you feed it, you know. So it really does get back to how we view, again, domination, how we view our treatment of everyone else around us, and whether rights advocacy is doing the appropriate thing, which I think is to urge people to opt out of exploitation in all its forms. So you embrace human rights as much as you embrace animal rights, and certainly there is a relationship.
Oh, absolutely. You've got you're involved with primarily primates sanctuary in Texas?
Yeah, sometimes over my head.
I mean, they're all huge things. So this is something I think a lot of people don't have any idea about what's going on.
Well, thank you, because that's my obsession. And, I didn't tell you that, but it's true that for many years, while we were just donors to the sanctuary, we also tried to establish within Africa an island project for chimpanzees. And knowing that there are lots of orphaned chimpanzees and chimpanzees that need sanctuary, and it doesn't mean yanking them out of Africa and bringing them to the United States. So the upshot of all of that today is, you know, that we sponsor an island project for chimpanzees in the Gambia, and the Gambia is a country that kind of runs through the middle of Senegal in West Africa. That's thrilling to go there in this remote area of the world and to see these three islands. I guess we've got 97 chimpanzees that are monitored and looked after there now, and the government is in a partnership with a foundation and Friends of Animals, so it's a cooperative arrangement, and we provide the financing. And 97 chimpanzees have baboons to have little battles with, and other monkeys, and gorgeous varieties of birds, but a life as close to what is normal as possible. The boundaries of the islands are really their perimeter, because they don't swim. So if they're on an island, they're not going to stray into the water. They consider water a hazard. In addition to that, back in October 2006, I got a call that the Texas Attorney General in Texas, of course, had raided the sanctuary, primarily primates in San Antonio, and that they had, on the suggestion of PETA, obtained allegations about neglect and abuse there, and therefore all the assets were frozen, and the staff didn't know what to do. They were thrown out of the place, and for a while some other people were in there with a court-appointed receiver. 6 months later, after I hired a law firm to try to defend the sanctuary and sort out the mess, because we didn't want to see the place dismantled with hundreds of monkeys and apes without homes or without decent care, we were asked by the AG's office to head up the new board of directors, and I agreed. And that was taking on a lot, because it meant the first year to try to improve the infrastructure of the sanctuary, we had to come up with $1 million to do that, and the year after that, another million, and then we had to build the reputation back. So it's been, you know, since May 2007, we've worked very hard. We've tripled, quadrupled the staff, brought in an on-site veterinarian. Today, the sanctuary is just gorgeous. I'm very proud of it. And it's a place of what we hope security for animals that are trapped in animal exploitation industries. You know, people will rally outside the primate lab and say, you know, stop torturing monkeys or some such thing, or to tell someone to stop using chimpanzees in commercials for a Super Bowl. And, of course, there are lots of good people rallying against the exotic pet trade, which makes lemurs and macaque monkeys and chimpanzees and orangutans and whatever trapped in people's homes for absurd purposes. The truth is, if they're going to be released from those industries, they need a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the place to go is usually the unheralded sanctuary. You know, those people really are on the front lines, but they're not getting the headlines, you know, and they're not getting the bulk of any national group's attention for the most part, and they're not getting the donations they need to really secure a future. So we're managing primarily primates. We're doing their administrative work, their fundraising work. I travel there every month. I help sometimes with hiring people. I certainly interfere constantly. I'm sure they tell you that. And I've learned a lot from them, because what I think the staff is excellent at is to be involved with the individual animals, the 400 or so. They know them. Their observations are excellent. Our vet is a dream. And raising the money is a challenge, because to run a place like that with 400 residents, you need a budget of $1 million or so a year. Habitat for spider monkeys can look wonderful for a few years, and then you need lots of repairs. The minute you put chimpanzees into any given area, you know, they start banging on it, right? They figure out a way to loosen up everything that's in perfect shape before they get in. So any sanctuary today for primates and other animals is constantly doing improvements and changes, and we're devoted to that for, you know, the rest of our lives here too, to help this place that really needed that kind of rescue and has survived against all odds.
Oh, I've just been holding my breath listening to all of this. There's just so many things that are going on in this world that shouldn't be, and we hear all the time that there is so much money out there, and so much of it goes to such ridiculous projects. It's good to know a certain amount is going to do really good things.
It's do hard work. I think if people can devote themselves to risk-taking, to stretching themselves, to doing things that aren't easy, that would be a boon for our civilization and this movement.
I like to think that we read that when the economies are struggling, that's when some of the greatest inspiration and the greatest work happens. So I'm hopeful that something good can come out of our economy being in the toilet at the moment, and that that people start to really think about what it is they want to do and why they're here on this planet, and that most of that energy will go to be doing some really, really good things.
Thanks so much. I agree.
Do you have an opportunity to be close with any non-human animals?
You mean it's like at the sanctuary, or certainly we have three cats and two dogs, and two of the dogs come to work here every day.
Okay.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're closer than close. But at the sanctuary, I have to confess, I have favorites, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I have spider monkeys that are just dear to me. In fact, a string of them and gibbons there and lemurs. There's one lemur named Jordan who I'm just head over heels over.
And to see when
other animals, at my house at home, you know, to watch squirrels who look like they're terrified of me, go up and down the tree and use a nesting box and whatever, I'm thrilled out of my mind. Really, animals give me a deep sense of joy. It's just true. And I'm hardwired for the confrontation involved in this work and the defense that these animals deserve. And very, very lucky to work here and to be able to express all of this.
I think those that are involved with close relationships with animals realize the joy that they get from this silent sort of bonding and communication. And we see it in so many different ways, that there are ways to heal different illnesses and emotional issues, that animals can do things that we cannot do. And
My dad used to say, you know, the dog doesn't talk back. And, you know, if you grow up and you have you get to reach a grown-up stage, you can appreciate that. You know, the forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm forgiven for a lot.
Well, Priscilla, thank you so much for talking with me today, and I love the work you're doing. Please visit friendsofanimals.org. And I hope that you continue to be energized and inspired and work hard for a very long time. The animals thank you.
You're wonderful. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and we're going to take a quick break and get back to talking about genetically modified food. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And this is the second half of our February 8th, 2012 show. We're going to move on to health and environment and talk about genetically modified food, a subject that doesn't get near enough attention. So we're going to give it a little bit today with Nick Brannigan, who's the author of I'm Eating What? The Health Risks of Genetically Modified Food and 10 Real-World Solutions to Avoid Them. It's a free ebook, and you can grab it at imeatingwhat.com. Welcome to It's All About Food, Nick Brannigan.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me on today.
Okay. So how did you get into this passion against genetically modified food?
Well, I first heard the term genetically modified GMO food years ago, but I took it as this was something that they wanted to do to the food supply. I didn't realize it was food that I was eating every day.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I heard a late-night talk radio show with Jeffrey Smith where he got into the details and the ins and outs of GMO foods. And at the time, I was still a very unconscious eater.
Yeah.
Still ate a lot of packaged foods, a lot of animal products. But I started checking the labels and the major crops at corn, soy, canola, sugar beet, cotton was in nearly everything that I was eating. So over time, I had a newborn baby at the time. And I started paying more attention to the labels that I was eating, to what she was eating.
Mm-hmm.
And it really bothered me that really no one knew about this topic. Like you said when you opened up, it's a subject that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Yep.
But it's food that we eat every day.
Well,
so I became more and more into, and not only into, you know, watching what I eat, but into advocacy work. And I took a speaker training through the Institute of Responsible Technology, which led me to writing this book, I'm Eating What?
By the way, I've had Jeffrey Smith on my show a while ago. I should get him on again, but he also hosts Echo Shock, which airs every Saturday at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. We love Jeff Smith and all the work that he's doing. And I'm glad that you're joining him to get this information out because more people need to be talking about it. There are reasons, though, that we don't hear much about genetically modified food unless you're really looking for it. And one of the reasons is the companies that have been promoting genetically modified organisms in food have been lobbying against labeling of our food products for a long time. So there's only clever kind of circuitous ways to know whether GMO are in our food, genetically modified organisms. We know that if we buy food that's organic, the food is not going to be genetically modified to a large percentage. And I say that because, unfortunately, genetically modified foods, as they grow unprotected in fields, have pollen just like other plants, and some of that pollen can actually contaminate other fields. And so even though we buy organic and want to believe that it's the highest quality possible, there is a chance that there are some genetically modified organisms in there. It's a very, very small percentage, but that's kind of the best we can do.
Yeah, that is a big issue with the organic products, is that they use the at-risk ingredients, which are the major crops that I stated, corn, canola,
mm-hmm.
soy, beet sugar, and what was the other one?
Soy, corn, canola,
cotton. Yeah, cotton seed. Yeah, slipped my mind because cotton seed, you don't find that
in
organic
product.
Oh, sure,
cotton oil. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it is true with organics. People don't know about the cross-contamination through pollen drift. That's why if you use these major ingredients to get them non-GMO verified, it's a process where they actually test the crops before they go to the processing to make sure they haven't been cross-contaminated with that GMO DNA, the transgenic DNA. Because it is possible. Now, some distributors do test it when it gets from the farms.
Mm-hmm.
They'll test the corn from an organic crop, and if it does contain the GMO DNA, they won't buy it. But that's really, you know, hard to know who actually does that, because the companies aren't going to, some companies will take it anyway because they don't want to lose their profit versus not having real organic food. And the unfortunate part is the USDA organic process would allow that crop with the GMO DNA to continue to be labeled organic. That's why if it does contain those five major ingredients, to make sure not only is it organic, but non-GMO project verified.
There, I know that some companies were actually getting their corn products from Europe to guarantee that the corn they were using did not have genetically modified organisms in it, because
yes,
we have so
European
much contamination
Union.
In the United States.
Yeah, that's very true, because 95% of the soy grown is genetically modified. Something around 88 to 90% of corn has been genetically modified, 95% of beet sugar. And in the European Union, there's some GMO crops grown, but they're few and far between, because the consumers pretty much rejected GMO foods in the late 90s, based on some press that it got then. And all the major American food companies withdrew GM ingredients from their European lines, but they kept them in the American products because Americans are so in the dark about what they eat, especially when it comes to this GMO food.
Okay, so what, I've heard this a lot, why should we care about eating or not eating genetically modified food?
Well, studies have shown that there are major health risks to eating GMO foods. For example, a study they did in Japan show that it suppresses the body's ability to get rid of, to digest, degrade, and detoxify toxic substances from the body. They also did studies that showing that it affects the Sertoli cells of the testicles in rats. And the main function of the Sertoli cells is to develop sperm. And there's a lot of evidence out there showing that GMO foods could lead to sterility.
Mm.
And not only in the animals that the food's fed to, but also in human beings as well. And there's only been one human feeding study done, and it didn't study any of these long-term effects. So we don't know the long-term implications of genetically modified foods, and that's one of the main reasons I would avoid them 100%, because 50, maybe 60 years ago, someone smoking a cigarette, you could say to them, you know, it's very bad what you're doing to your body right there. Cigarettes are bad for you. And they would call you a conspiracy theorist back then.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think there's a person on earth that smokes a cigarette that doesn't know what's bad for you. Is it going to be the same thing for GMO foods in 40, 50 years?
Yeah, doctors used to promote cigarettes as healthy.
Yeah, you see a lot of advertising saying doctors recommend this brand of cigarettes.
Yeah. I've read numerous reports that say that they've done long-term studies, and those studies are usually like 90 days. They're not long-term, and they're not on humans.
Yeah, in my research, the longest study I've come across is like a 24-month study on rats.
Mm-hmm.
And rats have very similar DNA code to human beings, but in just the 2 years, they are showing negative side effects in the rats.
Now, I'm always talking about how it's important to eat primarily a plant-based diet, organic, locally grown, and you were mentioning that a large percentage of the corn and soy that's grown in this country is genetically modified, and most of it is to feed animals, which ultimately become food for people. But those genetically modified organisms stay intact, and you can get them by eating the animals.
Yeah, it's definitely like I believe that the percentage is something like 80% is fed to these factory farm animals.
Mm-hmm.
So the number one thing you could do is go vegetarian. Now, personally, I follow a vegan diet, but I do support the organic dairy companies, because if people still want to get dairy products, by buying an organic one, that's right there you are drawing the support from all that GMO feed that's fed on these animals. And, like, for example, you can go to the store, and I don't eat eggs either, but you can see there's eggs that are in omega-enhanced. How do they enhance those eggs? They feed the chickens flax seeds. So the traits from the flax seed is transferring over to the final egg that comes out that you're buying. So if they're feeding these chickens and these animals GMO corn and GMO soy, I think it's a little it's a little obvious that that DNA is getting transferred over to their final product as well, the eggs and the dairy and the meat.
Yep. Well, I'm glad to hear you're not eating dairy and eggs. That's a good thing. But it is important to acknowledge that other people do. And when it comes to genetically modified, you know, even if we're not eating genetically modified, if plants are growing around, they can contaminate everything. And so we really want to get these things off the planet.
Yeah, like for the example, the beet sugar has contaminated Swiss chard, I believe, and conventional beets with the DNA, transgenic DNA. So you may get a beet thinking, oh, it's not genetically modified. Well, it actually could be. Fortunately, it's not sprayed with the deadly pesticide glyphosate, but we don't know what the GMO process is doing to us long term, not let alone the heavy chemical spraying that they do.
Now, one of the things that I think would help is proper labeling, and there's been all kinds of studies that have shown the power of some very simple labeling. There was one recently where they studied putting in a hospital on beverages that were labeled green were healthy, red were not healthy, and yellow were somewhere in between, and people went more for the green labeled beverages. It increased significantly from what they were doing before when it wasn't labeled. So there is definitely an impact in labeling. And the companies that make genetically modified food know that. That's why they don't want things labeled, although they'll talk and say that there's no difference in their food. And so it doesn't have to be labeled because the food isn't different.
Well, for them to say that is such an idiotic statement. It's in contrary to what they call the food. It's genetically modified.
Mm-hmm.
So by definition, it's different than a non-modified food. And there's no logical argument against labeling. Just like you said, they know they're going to lose all their profits. People are going to stop buying genetically modified food once they can clearly see the label on there. It's like when you go to people that drink orange juice. Some orange juice says 100% juice. Some orange juice says made from concentrate. Some people don't care if it's from concentrate. Some people want 100% juice. That's all it is. People just want to know what they're eating.
Yep.
And there's no logical argument against labeling.
It's not going to keep everyone away from genetically modified, but it's a first step.
Yeah, I mean, I am kind of on the side that if people want to eat that food, you know, best of luck to you. You should be able to eat it. It's just going back to the pollinator, if that is an issue, to where it is contaminating other crops, and that's not fair to consumers and to the organic farmers. But, you know, if you want to eat GMO foods, go right ahead. It's up to you. But people should have the right to know, and people should have a choice. And there's no logical argument against that.
Let's put the health, personal health thing aside, although what I'm going to say really is going to affect personal health anyway, but let's talk about the environment for a minute and how genetically modified foods affect the environment. And there's a number of different ways that growing GMO food has adverse effects on the environment.
Yeah, well, for people that don't know the GMO process, the main crops are designed to get heavily sprayed with a toxic herbicide and not die. The main herbicide is produced by Monsanto called Roundup. Main name is glyphosate. And they've been doing a lot of studies lately that have been coming to light that the glyphosate actually penetrates the groundwater. It's been found in the air in a couple southern states. It's been found in the rain.
Mm.
So the genetically modified process alone is bad enough through the pollen drift, but you spray this heavy herbicide on the soy plants, it kills all the weeds around it, but the soy doesn't die. And they've been finding that the weeds have been becoming more immune to the glyphosate spraying. They're calling them super weeds. So the response to that is, let's spray more herbicide on it. So the herbicide spraying has doubled since the planting of genetically modified soybeans. And you see a lot of spin from mostly Monsanto's, but all these chemical companies, where they talk about how pesticide spraying has gone down due to the BT cotton and BT corn. But what most people don't know, there's a difference between pesticide and herbicide.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the herbicide. I'm only recently, I found this out in my research for this booklet,
yep.
So this is news to me. So the herbicide spraying has gone way up, and the pesticide spraying may have gone down, but people are eating concentrated levels of pesticide now.
So let's just talk a minute. It's easy to know what the difference is. Pesticides kill pests like bugs.
Yeah.
Herbicides kill weeds, the plants that we don't, that interfere with the growth of the desired plant that you're growing for sale. But they're both toxic.
Yes, and, precisely.
Yeah, and when genetically modified foods were coming out and companies like Monsanto were promoting them, one of the things that they kept saying was that it was going to reduce, like you said, the use of pesticides, and this was supposed to be a great thing for the environment, but ultimately we're using more toxic chemicals in the form of herbicides.
Yeah, I think the number I saw was something like a 98% increase in spraying of herbicides. And it's just the church, the PR spin of these companies is they just don't use that word herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're saying may be true, but it, like I said, that's a spin too, because since the plants, the cotton and the corn produce their own pesticide, we're eating concentrated levels of it now.
Well, let's talk about that now. So there's another kind of genetically modified organism that enables the plant to produce what's normally a natural pesticide in their plant, in their own structure.
Yeah, what it's called is a BT toxin. It's made from a bacteria that is naturally occurring, and it's what's sprayed on organic crops. So what they did is they took this bacteria gene and they inserted it into the genes of corn and cotton, which are the main two BT crops. So now these corns produce their own pesticide, their own BT toxin, in concentrated levels. So the spraying has gone down, but now if you're eating a BT corn, you're eating concentrated levels of the BT toxin that you're not washing off. It's in the cells of the plant.
Well, the BT toxin also can go into the ground from the part of the plant that isn't harvested. There are bugs and small animals that might nibble on some of them and be affected by it too. And so there's just more of this BT around, and they will tell you that it's not toxic, but the levels are increasing, and certainly when we eat the food, the levels that we consume are a lot more than ever before.
Well, this variety of corn too, and this is something really important. If you haven't heard this, it may shock you, that this variety of corn is actually a registered pesticide through the Environmental Protection Agency. So if you're eating this genetically modified corn, you are eating what the EPA considers a pesticide.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah, mind-blowing, isn't it? And there's another issue with this, with what they're calling superbugs, is that bugs that are eating this BT corn and BT cotton, the insecticide splits their stomach open. But there's a small percentage of these insects that are immune to it. So as all the other insects die off, there's these insects that are immune to it, and they're mating and reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
So now all the insects in the area are all, quote-unquote, superbugs, and that's all there is. So they're eating
like,
the crops, and they're not dying from it.
Just like there are super weeds, there are superbugs.
Yeah, so the so-called benefit of both of these genetically modified crops are showing that eventually it's no longer going to benefit anybody.
I personally think what needs to be done, in addition to not using genetically modified seeds, is our farms need to be smaller. They're too big. These giant agribusinesses are growing all these monocrops, and it's such an unhealthy way to grow food. So we need to bring systems back that encourage small farmers, and then they can use organic permaculture techniques that nature provides for us, growing different plants and certain plants around other plants that inhibit pests coming around and eating the plants, and a farm that's small makes it possible for the workers and the farmers to survey the fields to see what's going on and make manual adjustments in order to protect the crops. And this is all doable on a small scale. We need to bring that back. And it's happening in small pockets here and there.
Yeah, and this is how food was harvested for thousands of years. This whole pesticide industry has only been around, I believe, 60 or so years.
Pretty much since after World War II.
Yeah, since World War II. So we look at this like this is the only way to do things, but it just food's been around for, what, how long? Longer than humans? Is that safe to say?
Sure.
There's a way that this has been done for thousands and thousands of years, and 60 or so years compared to millenniums, I think, you know, we have a better option than what we're doing now because that option was used long before it is now.
Well, part of the challenge is that there are more humans on Earth than ever before, 7 billion, and how do you feed all of those people?
It's not through genetic modification. That's a talking point. People call them GM myths. I call them talking points. That's all they are. They've been saying that's their number one. GMOs will feed the world. Well, even genetically modifying crops for 20 years, they're still starving people around. When are they actually going to feed the world?
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, because that's just something they say, and people hear that and say, oh, you know, that sounds reasonable. GMOs feed the world. Okay, that's fine. Without doing any further research on it.
Well, there are some really horrible stories that have happened around the world, in India, for example, and some other countries where farmers have used genetically modified seed and the yields have been terrible, and they've had a lot of debt that they weren't able to pay off and as a result committed suicide. There's been a lot of that.
Yeah, I believe there's actually a documentary coming out on that issue. It's something that I haven't looked into too much because it's a hard issue to look into. But there is a documentary, if it's not out already, it's coming out soon, that's regarding the suicides of the Indian farmers.
I saw one a few years ago that Vandana Shiva was involved with on that subject. Of course, I can't think of the name at this moment, but it was very difficult to watch. The stories were really, just really frustrating and upsetting, where people really put their heart and soul into what they're doing and things that all they wanted to do was improve their yields and maybe profit a little more to benefit their families. And what happened was things just became so dramatically worse.
Yeah, and what they do is they put a patent on these seeds, the biotech companies. So they actually own the seed. So if a farmer plants the seed, he's not allowed to save the seed, and if he does, then he's going on patent infringement. And Monsanto has sued hundreds of farmers over the years for using their patented seeds. And there's actually a court case right now going on in New York City where these farmers are suing them back, saying you shouldn't be able to patent these seeds, and if you do, you shouldn't be able to sue farmers for your transgenic DNA getting in our crops.
Well, that's good news. I'm glad to hear there's a suit in New York going on.
Yeah, I don't know the result of it yet. It's been going on for, I believe it started at the end of last month, so it's still pretty new. But it's one major step to go at least in the right direction for the protection of the farmers.
Okay, so how do you avoid genetically modified food?
Well, the first is to know the ingredients, not just the corn, canola, cotton, soy, and beet sugar, but all the derivatives, too. A lot of the stuff in these packaged foods usually come from corn or soy, like MSG, xanthan gum, sucrose, fructose. So you can do a web search and find out all those ingredients.
Mm.
Also, too, no honey that's not organic. Again, the animal products that are non-organic or should be to avoid. You can look for the non-GMO verified label and buy organic. Your best bet is making a transition over to mostly whole foods, because very few actual whole foods have been genetically modified. So when you start, you kind of take the process of the cook for yourself and go through the whole process of getting away from packaged food is the best way to avoid GMOs. I might also recommend supporting any local organic or non-GMO cafes in your area. Again, going to the small farms, where I live in Las Vegas, there's actually a handful of organic farms, and they have a CSA program, which is Community Supported Agriculture,
mm-hmm.
where they actually bring you vegetables every week. And obviously they don't do anything genetically modified. So those are just the ways to start. And I would recommend, too, if you live in California, support the labeling campaign going on there right now. They're going to start collecting signatures in mid-February to mid-April, and if they get roughly 800,000, it's going to be on the ballot in November to label GMO foods in California.
Who's now, behind this? Do you know what group's behind this?
Yeah, the website is labelgmos.org. Hmm. The group itself is the California Right to Know Committee. They've been supported by some companies like Dr. Bronner's or Magic Soaps and Nature's Path Organic Cereals. And also, their other website is carighttoknow.org. So if you live in California and you can volunteer for the campaign, or if you just want to know where you can sign your name to get GMOs labeled, that's one of the best things we can do right now, because if they have to be labeled in California, these companies are going to put them on all their packages, and they're probably just going to remove them from their products because they know the consumers aren't going to want to buy something that says genetically modified on it.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how that all works from a federal versus state level, but I'm glad that it's happening, and it should prove very interesting. But the best that we can do is support what we believe in with our dollars. And even though some foods may be tempting to buy because they're less expensive or they look really nice, they could secretly have things in it that you don't want to put in your body and your family's body. So genetically modified food is not the way to go.
Yeah, not at all. And in my book, there's 10 solutions in here. And I would recommend anyone that reads it, take these solutions and just kind of incrementally implement them into your life.
Where can people get it?
I'm eating what.com.
Just spelled all out.
imeatingwhat.com.
Great. Nick, thank you so much, and thank you for doing all that you're doing. It takes individuals to make change, and you're doing your part.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate you having me on today.
Okay, thanks for joining me, and take care. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. And join me next week. We're going to be talking with Molly Femister, who is the founder of Eatcology.com. So we'll be talking a lot about ecology and food. Thanks so much for listening. Take care. Have a delicious week.